Thank you very much for coming to this evening event. I find this year's teaching tour theme very, very appealing. It's not just a way to happiness, it's highway to happiness. All right? I think in societies like Hong Kong, where time and efficiency is very important.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome again. Ah Jong Brown doesn't need much introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway. Ah Jong Brown was born in a working class family in London in 1951. He graduated with a first class honours degree in theoretical physics from Cambridge University. After graduation, he became a high school teacher for 1 year before travelling to Thailand to become a Buddhist monk. Having been a Buddhist monk for now over 40 years, he is the abbot of Bodhiyana Monastery in Serpentine, Western Australia. Ajahn Brahm is a highly sought-after speaker. He has been invited to give talks at the United Nations as well as the headquarters of Facebook and Google. He is also... And CUHK, of course. And by the way, this is his third time coming to the CUHK to give a talk. So thank you very much, Chinese University. And last but not least, Ajahn Brahm is the author of many international bestsellers, which have been translated into more than 20 languages, including Good, Bad, Who Knows, Bear Awareness, Kindness, Opening the Door of Your Heart, The Art of Disappearing, and also one more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't that enough?
That's enough. Okay. So without further ado, please join me in giving Ajahn Brahm a round of applause.
Because when I was first got interested in things like meditation and Buddhism, I still remember a Zen master coming to London. That would be about 1969, 1970. Many, many years ago, and I always remember what he said to me. He said that anyone who ever writes a book has to spend the next 7 lifetimes born as a donkey. So I've got a long time as a donkey, so if you see any donkeys in your next life, be kind to them. That might be Ajahn Brahm. All he really meant is that sometimes people can be very intellectual, and the intellectual just misses a lot of the points. We can actually read, we can argue, but does that really make us happy? Yes, you can get a lot of knowledge, but what's the point of knowledge if you can't use it to have a happy, healthy life, and to have a good relationships, lots of friends, and have been joy in your life? Is knowledge just to get BAs and MAs and PhDs? I know that many people get a bachelor's and they get double bachelor's, double degrees, which means they're called Baba. Ajahn Brahmali, he's got 2 masters, so he's Mama. We call him Mama Brahmali. And you know what PhD means? Permanent head damage, that's what somebody told me. But no, not all PhDs are like that. Many, many doctors are really wonderful people. But as long as we use that knowledge, it's actually to create some wisdom. Somebody once, actually just this afternoon, they asked me, I never answered the question totally, why did I become a monk? Because I had great opportunities in life at a place like Cambridge University. But even though that because of that collegiate system, you could associate, have dinner and just hang out with Nobel Prize winners. But even though these were Nobel Prize winners, still there was something missing in their life. Now they weren't really sort of, they were smart, they were brilliant in science, but they were stupid in life. And I still remember that I kept on with my science, still keep well connected. And there was one fellow who I met just maybe 10 or 15 years ago, because he was coming through Australia, had enough connections to get an invitation to dinner with him. Not I ate anything, I was just wanting to talk to people. And that was Sir Roger Penrose. Roger Penrose was the person who discovered black holes. You know, he did the maths to find out the existence of black holes. And that it was from his research that Professor Stephen Hawking, who I also would have bumped into in Cambridge, but he wasn't famous then, he wasn't in a wheelchair at that time. But he was, you know, he used the discoveries of Sir Roger Penrose to get the idea of the Big Bang Theory. So these were really amazing sort of intellects. But when you actually get to see them and know them, especially Sir Roger Penrose, he was like a wallflower. You couldn't have a conversation with him. Many people were trying to talk with him about all sorts of interesting things, and he would not be able to continue their conversation. As far as I know, he didn't have a partner at all. He was one of those professors who was brilliant in front of a whiteboard, but not very smart in life. And to me, I thought there was something missing there. And against that, then I remember just, you know, because I was a Buddhist and most of my friends were Christians, that, you know, I was very proud being a Buddhist at that time. So when some of my Christian friends, they said they were going to volunteer to do some social work, you know, in the local hospital for those who have mental disabilities, I thought, if they can do it, I'd better do it myself. I'm not going to be surpassed by my Christian friends. And so I decided to go along as well. Not because I was trying to be compassionate, more I was just trying to keep up with the Joneses. If they could do it, I would do it. So it was totally out of pride. But I went and spent every Thursday afternoon for the next 2 years, and I started off with pride, just working, doing some simple occupational therapy with people with Down syndrome. And at first I thought I was giving, doing something good for others. But it was afterwards I started to learn just that these people, I preferred their company than be around great scientists. It was strange, but I often tell the story that if I had some problems in my mind, my emotional world. I remember once I'd just broken up with a girlfriend. I wasn't born a monk, so I had girlfriends and messed around. So I'd just broken up with a girlfriend. The following day I went to do my social work afternoon. And as soon as one of these people who was supposed to be disabled saw me, they came running towards me and gave this enormous hug. And they knew that there was something upsetting me. And how they knew that was really just mind-boggling. And it was also very difficult for an English young man in the 1960s, 70s to take a hug from another man in public. I wasn't gay, I was heterosexual. To be hugged was really sort of, you know, very uncomfortable. But these people who are supposed to be disabled taught me so much that the world of understanding is not just done by experiments or done by logic, but there's something much more going on in this world, and that was the emotional intelligence. I know that these days people like Daniel Goleman in the United States wrote a great best-selling book about emotional intelligence, and it's well worth a read. But this is where you found that quality, even though it had no name. And so I learned so much, and probably much more of things which were useful from working with those who the world said should be institutionalized, separated, and were called disabled. And now, looking back on those times, it's wonderful that in our modern world, especially in places like Australia, they're not separated at all. They're part of life. And it's wonderful that they're part of life. And you do learn so much know, just how to just to let go and don't sort of always intellectualize things. To have that emotional understanding of life, which allows you to have the happiness of connection with other human beings. For example, one of my old stories. I know people sometimes say, why do you keep telling these old stories which you've heard before? But even so, if you get some of these bands like the Rolling Stones, who are still performing, they perform things you've heard before. They don't write any new music. It's like the wonderful oldies which you enjoy hearing again. But this was the story of the couple who had just been married. And a few days after their marriage, they were having a walk after lunch in the local park in the gardens when they heard a sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And she said, oh, darling, can you hear that sound? That's a chicken. And he said, what did you say? A chicken. And he said, look, it is not a chicken. That is a duck. I am a scientist. I'm an ornithologist. That is a duck. It goes quack, quack. It must be a duck. She said, no, I am certain that is a chicken. He said, it's a duck. She said, it's a chicken. He said, it's a duck. And she started to cry. It's a chicken. And he looked into her eyes and remembered why he married her. And he squeezed her hand gently and said, darling, I think you may be right. It is a duck. So it's a chicken, sorry. I was empathizing with a man, being a man myself. It is a chicken. And it went quack, quack again. Yeah, it's a chicken. And she said, oh, thank you, darling. And that afternoon, they had a wonderful walk. And that evening, had a wonderful hot dinner. And the moral of that story in life, does it really matter if it's a chicken or a duck? Is that worth having divorce proceedings about? But you find, people tell me, in life, marriage, partnerships, so often that we waste the harmony, the peace, the joy of our relationships, arguing over things which really don't matter. Small things, like whether it's a chicken or a duck. So in that version of the story, number one, for happiness' sake, keep priorities right. What's more important, you know, is your love, peace and harmony. Much more important than being right. And number two, sometimes we always think we're right, and it turns out we're wrong. Just because it goes quack, quack, does not necessarily mean it's a duck. That could be a chicken from Fukushima nuclear disaster zone, flying to Hong Kong, mutated. So just because it goes quack, quack, does not mean it's a duck. It's a chicken. Harmony. So it goes the same way. If you're going on a nice walk together with your darling husband, and your husband says, oh, you know, you hear it goes quack, quack, oh, listen to that duck. And your husband says, oh, that's not a duck, that's a cow. I agree with him. It's worth it. So there are times when we argue and it just creates disharmony. And of course, you know, that happens in politics, in life, and most things, just small things, especially at home. So no need to argue about little things. You know, that's just a simple story, but that has saved so many marriages. So many marriages that I remember just getting an invitation at one of the first big invitations to go to Bangkok because it was the Australian Embassy in Bangkok. Got a copy of that book. And I was invited, and the tickets all paid for by four couples. Two of those couples had been divorced, and the other two had a trial separation. And because of that one story, they came together again. And they said, thank you so much. We want you to come here just to say thank you and to share those stories with others. I mean, in fact, writing books, the first book which I ever wrote, it was called Opening the Door of Your Heart in the English version, and in the United States, Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung? I tried to make them say Who Ordered This Truckload of Shit, but I'm not supposed to say that, so they called it Dung. But anyway, that was the title there. And how that book came about was interesting. I've been telling these stories and anecdotes for such a long time, and there was one lady who had been going through a very bad divorce. And for those of you who are unfortunate enough to go through those terrible, terrible times, it's a very, very yucky, unpleasant, it's a very, very powerful negative experience. And she said that some of those stories had actually made her survive and just not kill herself. Because she was so depressed, the meaning of her life had suddenly disappeared, and now she was having to build her life again. And it was really, really hard for her. And she said, my stories, which she heard, had saved her life. And she said, it was almost criminal of me not to share those stories more widely by putting them in a book. So you know what my reply was? Oh, I'm too busy. But she was really smart. What she did, she said, well, I'll write the stories myself. And so she started writing them, and she gave me the first draft. And it was so hopeless, so terrible, that I thought, oh my goodness, I better do it myself. you learn a lot of psychology, being a monk. But anyway, so I wrote this down, and one interesting thing about work, writing, creativity, is that you can only do 1 or 2 hours a day. For those stories, 1 hour a day, 2 weeks, and I've done the first half of the book. Just wrote it longhand, because I couldn't type, didn't have a computer at that time. And someone has got the manuscript, and it's faultless. There's no sort of correcting, because you learn how to be really peaceful, and doing meditation, and then just let it flow, and don't interrupt it. It's like creative writing, but without any corrections needed. And that's the manuscript. And so I've got someone to type it out afterwards, and then when they typed it out on the CD, how do you get a publisher? But before I go to the publisher's story, this is something which is important in universities about creativity and productivity. I did actually read something which I'd known a long time. It was an article from the BBC website about what we call creativity, that a human being is only allowed, and maybe it only can do, 3 or 4 hours a day of really creative work. The rest of the time, you're wasting your time. Which is one of the reasons why, when we have our 8-hour work weeks, or maybe in university, 10-hour, 12-hour, 13, 14-hour work days, most of that you spend just checking your SMSs, or just dulling out. Because to actually do work, really creative work, which is important in the university, you have to have just a little bit of peace. Have you ever noticed that when people are in school, you all did, you had your a recess in the morning, lunch hour, another recess in the afternoon, and then finished by 4 or 5 in the afternoon. Because any child psychologist knows the brain just cannot absorb so much information so fast. It just doesn't work. However, we reject all of that. We don't have rest time anymore. We just work right through. And it is my theory my theory, being born in England, because I know the English a long time ago, when they were working, they would always have morning tea. They would always have morning tea. They would have lunch. And then afternoon high tea, yes. And I think once they stopped having their morning tea and afternoon tea, that is where they lost their empire. They stressed out like everybody else instead of relaxing, being creative. So it's important to not work so hard, but to work smart, not hard. So maybe you don't have your morning tea and afternoon tea in Hong Kong University. But you know they did have that in the Cavendish Laboratories in Cambridge, where I used to hang out. That was the physics laboratories. And that was every scientist had to go to morning tea and afternoon tea. And it was when they had their afternoon tea and morning tea, they'd have laminated tables. And they would have felted pens available. And all these great physicists will be writing down their equations with a cup of tea and a bun or a sandwich in the morning and afternoon. And that is when they got their synergy from other scientists, and that's where they made their breakthroughs, in the tea rooms of the Cavendish Laboratory. So many breakthroughs and Nobel Prizes appeared on the tables of the tea room. When I heard that, I remember looking at those ladies who were serving tea and who were cleaning up afterwards and wondering how many of them were KGB spies. But anyhow, just to have a bit of a break is where actually you have your happiness and productivity. Because people always think, yes, you know, we do have to be successful in life. This is the university, you know, you've got to pass your degrees or whatever, you've got to do research, you've got to be able to manage and be successful. And for goodness sake, don't keep working, pushing, because what that does, you get sick, you get sort of unhappy, and also that you don't produce very much. Ask any, the old Harvard Business School, I do this every year, how heavy is my cup? The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, I keep holding it, and my arm starts to ache. After 2 minutes, I'm in pain. After 3 minutes, I'm in agony, and a very dumb monk. What should I do when it gets too heavy to hold? Put it down, rest. And then, after a minute, you pick it up again. It's not a minute because I haven't got that time. It's comfortable. It's actually less heavy, easier to hold. That is the cause of what we call stress in this world. Stress has got nothing to do with how much work you have on your plate. Nothing at all to do how many responsibilities and duties you have. It's got everything to do with you don't know how to rest and recharge when it's the right time. Which is one of the reasons why we do have, when I go to places like Google, I go to or Facebook, they all have meditation rooms, chill out rooms, sleep pods. Do you have a sleep pod in this university? Maybe it's my talk, that's when people go to sleep, I don't know. You know, that's really weird. People keep telling me that. Some people are like, all my talks are just on so many podcasts. And that sometimes that people say that that's how they go to sleep at night. They, you know, start listening to my talk and they fall fast asleep. And honestly, I still can't figure out whether that's a compliment or that my talks are boring. But it doesn't matter, as long as you find a good night's sleep, I'm happy. But anyhow, just learning just how to not work so hard and to be able to relax, that's an important part about happiness and productivity. And this is the last talk I'm giving you. I'm going to give a little deep piece of psychology now. Because some of you have heard many of these talks many times before. But the deep, and I've got to go back to how the book was published, but with the nature of the human mind. Remember, as a Buddhist monk, I spent so many years observing, hours, days, months, understanding how the human mind works. And the one thing which I've noticed is just one way of looking at this thing called a human mind. There's two parts to it. One is the active part of the human mind, the thing which tries to plan, remember, complain, work it all out, taking notes. We call that the doing mind. It does stuff. It's very active, always thinking, always restless. The other part of the human mind is called the knowing. It just knows. It's passive, receives information without reacting or judging or figuring out the consequences. The knower. Now, I do remember, as a scientist, as a physicist, doing experiments, you had to really notice just how your mind was reacting to the results as they came out from the machines and as you noted them down. You must be very careful just to know without reacting, not do anything. Collect all the data first without judging it. Otherwise, you get some weird anomalous data which never made sense and you think, oh, it was wrong. And you would just admit it, forget it, just scrub it out. And it's sometimes those strange results, that's where you get breakthroughs from. But sometimes we judge before all the information comes in. And so I learned, even as an observational scientist, to be able to just to know without thinking what it means yet. To have mindfulness, awareness, rather than reacting and doing things. And that was not just the modern idea of awareness. There was something else going on there, which again, being in the forefront of all this, being quite well known and so being influential in our mindfulness movement, what you did find out was that when you stop doing things, when you relax more, when you stop planning, holding all the weight of the past memories, complaining, when you learn how just to be still and just to know, your mind re-energizes. You actually literally wake up. Your awareness grows stronger and more powerful. In other words, after you've relaxed, just being aware, don't react, don't do anything, don't plan, don't check your text messages, just to learn how to rest and relax. After a short while, your mind energizes. You can see, hear, feel so much more deeply. Little things. An example, when I was in Cambridge, great, I had that training to explore and challenge. I did a meditation retreat in 1970. We were allowed to have exercise, a walk, 1 hour every morning. And because I knew that part of Cambridge, I would always head for the Botanical Gardens at Cambridge. It was in Bateman Street, the back entrance, if anyone knows Cambridge. And there I would go intending to have some exercise, a walk. But at the entrance to the Botanical Gardens, there was this incredibly beautiful clump of bamboo. I've never, ever in my life seen such a beautiful clump of bamboo before. And I understood why in Chinese watercolors you always see bamboo, or most commonly. And the reason, it's a very simple plant, but it's like graceful, it's almost sensuous. They're thick at the bottom, and it just it gets thinner so gradually, so beautifully as it sort of bends. And even the leaves are not really thick and clunky, even those are really thin and sensuous. And the colors of the bamboo, Again, they're not like bright, like roses or carnations. They're very, very subtle. And it's a very wonderful thing to see that clump of bamboo swaying in the early morning breeze, you know, just at the entrance of the botanical gardens. And as I looked, you know, just quite surprised that such a beautiful clump of bamboo was there, I just was standing there, enchanted by that clump of bamboo. I was standing there for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then at least I got some sensibility that if someone saw this young student staring in awe without moving at a clump of bamboo, they would have called the medics to take me away to the mental institution, because you're not supposed to really be doing things like that. I still also remember a similar story when our first monastery opened up in Sussex. It was very difficult to find a place to do meditation. So there was one disciple who was a clinical psychiatrist. It's amazing how psychology, psychiatrists, understanding of the mind. A lot of those get their ideas from, you know, meditators, things which really work. But anyway, this doctor, she was the head of psychiatry in the local institute for those with mental disabilities who were institutionalized in those days. And she lived in a small English village. She had an old manor house, and she thought this would be a wonderful place to have a retreat. So, they had a retreat there, maybe 30 or 40 people doing some meditation. And part of the meditation, they do this walking meditation. I don't know if you've seen some of the books by the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh. They're doing walking meditation, walking really peacefully, very slowly. And so, they had about 30 or 40 of these meditators walking really slowly in the garden, very mindfully. And you know English people, if you don't know, I'm one of them, it's true, that, you know, they're very nosy in the village. So one of them was looking through the window, seeing what was going on, and saw all these weird people just walking so slowly. They knew that was in the grounds of the head psychiatrist in the local mental institution. So she added one and one up and made three, and she thought she brought some of her patients home. And so she called the police, and the police came along to arrest all those meditators and take them away. And it took a lot of explanation to say that these weren't crazy people, these were meditators. So be careful what you do. But anyway, there was I, just standing still, watching this clump of bamboo, and I'd have been taken away, you know, because people, that's not a strange thing to do. They probably thought I was on drugs. I wasn't on drugs. I was just being very peaceful. So there was a bench close by. I sat down to watch. Sitting down, you could do things. Standing up was weird. So I looked at that clump of bamboo for about 50 minutes. And only went back because I needed breakfast. The next day I went back again. 8 days I went there. And I never finished with that clump of bamboo. It was the most beautiful clump of bamboo I'd ever seen in my life. And then retreat finished. Went back for studies. One free afternoon. In those days in university, you actually did have a free afternoon. Maybe not these days, I don't know. But anyway, I had a free afternoon. And I went back to my most beautiful clump of bamboo just to visit it, after about a week of just doing studies. And I was shocked. I couldn't find my beautiful clump of bamboo. All I saw was this dry, desiccated, dusty, weak piece of reed. Bamboos, they're not really supposed to be in the climate of England. It wasn't beautiful anymore. It didn't captivate me. And I wondered why. It was the same plant. The only thing which was changed was my mind. My mind was now tired with all the busyness of work, social life in a Cambridge college. My mind had closed up. It couldn't see the beauty anymore. And those were some of the things which I understood about the nature of wisdom, seeing deeply, seeing beauty, and the nature of happiness. If you think too much, if your brain works too hard, you get so tired, you're not fully depressed, but you're half depressed. Your food doesn't taste that delicious. Colors are gray. You get critical of other people. You get negative. You don't sleep well. You're tired. If you could only take a rest, your brain power increases. Instead of wasting energy and doing stuff, the energy goes to just knowing. Your mindfulness gets charged up. It gets empowered. And for those of you who know some British poetry, William Blake, to 17th century mystic, artist and poet, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. That fellow had an idea of what it means to see deeply into things, to see a world in a grain of sand, to be able to look at something like a kombu and see what other people can't see, to see a heaven, delight, beauty, happiness in this tiny little flower emerging amidst the grass. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand. Yeah. Eternity in an hour. It's not regarding my talk, which is supposed to last an hour. I hope that doesn't feel like an eternity. But it was just an hour just rhymed with flower, whereas a moment does not rhyme with flower. So that's why I use the, you know, it's just the requirements of poetry. But that really showed me just some of the reasons where the secret of happiness lies. And there is something really to that. If you know how to relax and rest, then you don't feel tired, you're happier, the food tastes more delicious, the people you live with are far more attractive, life is more delightful, everything starts to glow and be happier. Free happiness and joy and creativity. Amazing combination, which is why I could write a book just in 1 hour for 2 weeks by hand without making mistakes, not using whiteout, and didn't have any sort of great sort of stuff like you have these days on computers. I know how it was published. It's great when sort of you allow things to happen naturally, because I had the manuscript on an old CD, and then I went to give a talk in Melbourne University. And when I was in Melbourne University after the talk, just like here, afterwards somebody came along and they said, "Oh, wonderful talk. I work for a publisher. If ever you want anything published, please give it to me." Here he is. I just handed it to her. No effort, no seeking for other publishers, it just happened that way. I love it like that, because sometimes when things are meant to happen, you have some power, it just things happen. Without any stress or striving. That is a brilliant part of life. Really just creativity, success, without effort. It seems too good to be true, but that's how it works. But these days, depression and anger, which comes from depression, and just people not being able to live with one another, well, I always think they're all connected together with this general tiredness of human beings. When I was in Kuala Lumpur, we were doing a seminar for 15 to 25 year olds. And I never thought of this. Some other genius wrote down, one of the questions they would have to answer was, what is your most troublesome emotion? What emotion really is the one which, you know, gives you so much strife? And I thought it was like pride, you know, trying to get on in life, or, parents, or lust. But you know what, the biggest emotion there, which they felt, was exhaustion. And when they wrote that, you know, the clear winner, 60%, you know, without colluding, said they were so tired. And that really shocked me. 15 to 25 year olds, instead of enjoying their life and playing around, they're already exhausted. Why? You know, come back to when you were 15, it's so hard. You know, you got your peers always telling you you've got to be beautiful, you've got to be strong, you've got to get a girlfriend or boyfriend, be attractive. At the same time, you know, the schoolwork is getting very tough. You're getting your O levels and A levels, important time of your life. And then your parents are on your back to make sure you do really well in those exams. Life is just so demanding, 15 to 25 years of age. And people, instead of learning how to enjoy that life, they're already exhausted and it doesn't even get better from there. You really push yourself so hard, working till, you know, you get so you can't even sleep well at night. Can you take a day off? When you do have a day off, Chinese New Year holidays, what did you do? Did you go, I've got to have you visit your parents or whatever, but is it possible actually to have a family reunion on Skype? Thinking outside the box. But anyway, that we get so tired. Many of us can't take it. We get depressed. So exhausted that, you know, we just go into depression. Others, we fight, we just put off depression until we get just so frustrated. Others get angry. Others just get so angry that people they love, they take it out on them. It's really weird that why is it that husbands and wife, you know, husband, our partners, you know, you sort of come home late, tired, and you just shout at your wife or your husband. You know why? It's because underneath that, people think that it's a call for help. Husband, wife, please understand. It's not that you've done anything wrong. It's just I'm exhausted. They call it fencing, letting go, hoping that your partner will understand. It's nothing to do with them. You haven't done anything wrong. It's just I'm just totally tired. So because of that tiredness, that is one of the biggest, in my idea, problems in life, destroying much happiness and peace in our life, and also the health as well, not just depression. Incidences of cancerous. To me, it's just the tiredness, our modern work life. It's not the toxins in the environment. To me, anyway, it's more just the pressure you have in your life. So, we can do something about that. And it's not you all have to become monks or nuns, that's not what you're asking. Not to change, you know, just the economy of a place like Hong Kong. But learn how to take time out so you can be creative, innovative, so you're not so tired. Because when you're not so tired, you can produce more. Putting things down like this when you're tired, learning how to relax and rest. Harvard Business School calls it an investment of time. So you can actually do more, produce more. I am a highly productive monk. I have many responses, not just writing books and doing all sorts of stuff. And because of that, why? I know that, you know, that I give talks like this all over the place. I gave a talk like this at a big ceremony over in, I was in a big hall in Singapore to maybe about 3,000-4,000 people. And at the end of my talk, when it came to question time, this guy came up and said to me, he's actually on the microphone, said, it's all very well, Ajahn Brahm, you're a monk, you live in a monastery, you don't live in the real world, you know, you don't know what it's like. And I can give as good as I take. I sometimes am very combative. And I said, listen, sir. And I told him what I've been doing just that day. I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I was doing all sorts of work. Even when I have lunch, it's work. Because it's a ceremony. People give me food and they ask me questions. Even when you go to the toilet, it's work. Honestly, here in the Jockey Club auditorium of the Polytech, you know, after giving a talk, I was signing all these books, having photographs taken. I really wanted to go to the loo. They wouldn't let me, but I finally got in there. I was bursting. I made it into the gentlemen's toilets in the foyer. And as soon as I got into the gentleman's toilet, there was a gentleman, he just finished washing his hands, he turned around, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, I need to ask you about my meditation." Even in the toilets it's work. So I said, "I've been working all day." And it was about 10 o'clock at night. And then he wanted to, you know, just to reply to my answer. So he got to the microphone and said, "Wow, Ajahn Brahm, I never realized that monks had to work that hard in our modern world. I always wanted to become a monk one day, but not now." I lost the potential monk. Stupid Ajahn Brahm. Should have seen that one coming. But anyway, you can work hard. Healthy, smart, be productive. So yeah, I do know what I'm talking about. And hopefully that this is where you can have a highway to happiness without changing your profession, your job, your lifestyle. It's just how you do things, not what you do. That is where the idea of the highway to happiness comes from. There is something which highways sometimes get congested. There's traffic jams, such as the Cross Harbour tunnels, which I've been stuck in before. What do you do when you get stuck in a traffic jam? Do you complain? Do you honk your horn? Do you get road rage? Or do you think, what a wonderful opportunity this is to relax? Or do you still think that this is a wasted opportunity and you should just, you know, check your text messages or something? Please understand that your life is not always busy. You do have many what I call in-between moments when you've left a destination you've yet to arrive, when you're sitting in the restaurant and your food has not come, you are waiting in the surgery and the doctor hasn't called you in yet. There's so many moments which we waste in our life, the in-between moments of life. If we can only learn how to grab those in-between moments and learn how just to be. I often say that in Hong Kong, being in here for 9 days, apparently this is my 11th time in Hong Kong. You know, in all these years in Hong Kong, there are very few human beings who live in Hong Kong. I hardly ever see a human being in Hong Kong. I was in New York, London last year. Very few human beings. There's many human goings and doings, but very few human beings. Are you a human being or a human going somewhere? Or instead of just being here, try it. See if you can sit down and just be instead of doing something or going somewhere. This is what I mean by grabbing the in-between moments of your life. By grabbing those in-between moments, it's amazing how good that is for your health. How much more you notice, how much more you can understand your own bodily health and the truths of relationships. The in-between moments of life are what we miss. That way, you can learn just how to be happy. You don't need much to be happy in Hong Kong. So, not just a highway to happiness. People always strive to get the bigger car. Don't get a bigger car. I always say that because I'm Theravada, his other name is Hinayana. We're a small vehicle. Small vehicle is much better for the environment and it's easier to find parking places. Small vehicles are good. Not just that. I was mentioning about small houses and apartments in just the previous talk I gave. Why do people love to live in big mansions? Again, my parents were very poor. I promise I've told this story. I'm not quite sure how old I was, but maybe 6, 7 years of age. It could have been a couple of years later, I'm not sure. But my father, because he was sick, he suffered from asthma. And very often he was at home or in a hospital. So we had a small, what we call a council flat, in a poor part of London. I didn't realise it was poor until later on I wondered, well, why were most of my friends migrants? Because, you know, migrants, when they first come to a country, they usually live in the poor quarters. It was wonderful having so many people from different cultures I grew up with. But that when my, in that very small home, I remember that, I don't know if it was my mother or father, they had put a pound note, the bills, only £1, but that was a lot of money for them, above the little coal fire. You had to have a coal fire, otherwise you'd freeze to death. I had a coal fire, and somewhere or other a breeze came, and the £1 note just went into the fire and started burning. And my father tried to take that £1 note from the hot coals. He burnt his hand. And my mother, seeing £1 go up in flames, she started weeping and crying. You know, that was legitimately poor, financially. But I had to share a bedroom, a small bedroom, with my brother all our life. Yes, we'd fight, but there was no place to escape. So we learned how to love one another. He became a banker. I became a penniless monk. Opposite end of the spectrum, but you wouldn't know it, because we love each other. My parents would fight and argue as well. But they'd argue in front of us. There was no place to escape. And after arguing, they'd make up in front of us. And I always remember the times when my father and mother would look at each other and the kids were looking on, my brother and I, and they would hug and kiss and say sorry. What I learned from that, because we were really close in a small apartment, was that it's natural to have differences of opinion, sometimes to fall out. But the wonderful part of that was the reconciliation which happened afterwards. It was almost that I looked forward to my parents falling out, because I knew that soon afterwards there'd be this wonderful reconciliation, saying sorry and expressing their love in front of their kids. That's what I learned from my parents. That was my inheritance, as long as many other things as well. So what that meant to me was small apartments are the best. Against that, there was a woman, somebody sent me the article, who won the British lottery, £49 million. Cash, not taxed. And when she got the money, the first thing she did was buy a huge mansion in Sussex. She sold that mansion 1 year later at a great loss and bought a tiny townhouse. And you know why? Because she said in the big mansion, you know, where rich people live, she was in one part of the house, her husband was in another part of the mansion, didn't know where her husband was, her son was somewhere else, her daughter was somewhere else. She never saw her loved ones, her family. And she realized that was breaking up those beautiful family bonds. The huge mansion was destroying the thing which was most important to her in life. friends, loved ones. So she sold it, bought a very small townhouse so she can see her husband many times a day, and her daughter and her son. Small is beautiful. You can ask maybe your parents or grandparents. In olden days, a small little house and maybe three or four kids in the same bed, growing up together. Now, when somebody snores, we get really upset. But I'll tell you a story about snoring. There was this person who, it was during, I think, the Australian Open, you know, the tennis championship. And he was trying to get a room to stay in Melbourne. And because of the big sporting event, you couldn't get a room anywhere. And so he managed to find a hotel, a cheap hotel. And he said, well, there is one room available. It's a shed. There's already one occupant in it. This old man is very kind. He doesn't mind a person, you know, sleeping in the other bed, you know, the two single beds. But no one is ever able to go to sleep because he's really a loud snorer. He snores so loudly that no one's ever been able to sleep in that room. And this gentleman said, oh, no problem, I can do this. So he went in that room, and the next morning, you know, when he checked out, how did you go? He said, I sleep like a log, no problem. Wow, you're the first person ever to be able to do that. What happened? Easy, he said. You know, just a little bit of emotional intelligence, skillful means. He said, as soon as I was in my pajamas, I just went over to this old guy's bed and I gave him a big kiss on the cheek, and he stayed awake for the rest of the night while I slept. It's okay if I say that story, but anyway, it's a good introduction to get you awake again in the much more serious stuff. But this is in a small house. We learn to get on together, to cooperate. Sometimes I wonder, why is it that, you know, men and women, you know, they can't sort of accommodate together these days. They're getting divorced and arguing. We've lost something. We've lost the ability to live with another human being. Because if you've got kids, for goodness sake, don't give them their own room. Put them in, you know, with, you know, brothers together, sisters together. So they have to learn how to get on together. Otherwise, you know, when they, you know, living with sort of their partner in life, of course they won't be able to do it. They haven't learned the emotional skills. So sometimes poverty is a great blessing, in the sense that I learned how to love people and have that emotional intelligence, which is an important part of happiness. So these are little tricks. And if you have heard these stories before, I'm going to finish off with the Einstein story. Because I don't think I've said this in this time before. Anyway, I know that sometimes people complain, say, Attenborough, can you get some new stories? Some new tales? But there was, some time ago, when Albert Einstein became a famous scientist over in Europe, he got an invitation to give a teaching tour in the United States on the East Coast of all the most famous universities. And he went by boat, because they didn't have aircraft in those days, at least not sort of aircraft which were reliable. So he went on boat, and because all they had was some newspapers, people didn't really know what Albert Einstein looked like. So they did arrange a car with a chauffeur to take him from university to university to give his lecture on general relativity. And when, after going to about six or seven universities, the chauffeur happened to mention to Albert Einstein, said, I've heard your talk so many times, I think I can give it myself. And Albert Einstein, just now wanting to have a bit of fun, said, okay, let's give it a try. So before they got to the next university, they swapped places. And the chauffeur sat in the back, and Albert put a chauffeur's cap and uniform on. And when they sort of got to the university, the vice chancellor just opened the door for the person in the back, the chauffeur, and said, "Oh, welcome to our university, Professor Albert Einstein. We're so honored that you can come here." Took him up to, you know, the place where the faculty eat, and gave him a nice dinner, a nice wine. The chauffeur was enjoying every minute of it. And when he actually gave the lecture, it actually worked. He'd heard those stories so many times, the lecture so many times. He gave such a wonderful explanation of general relativity, he got a standing ovation. Except for one professor. One professor in the back was a bit suspicious. This fellow looked a bit young, and he spoke with a Brooklyn accent rather than a European one. So he thought, maybe there's something up. So he asked the person giving the lecture, the chauffeur. He said, "Professor Einstein, can you please answer this question?" It was a very deep question on general relativity. And the chauffeur looked at the professor, the questioner, and said, "Professor, that is such a simple, basic question, so simple. Even my chauffeur sitting in the back can answer that." So, is this really Ajahn Brahm sitting in front of you? Or is it my chauffeur who's outside? Okay, so thank you for listening. Now we have the best part, the questions and the answers. So, first of all, was it a good talk? Thank you. It depends how you look upon the world as terrible. Look at Mr. Trump. Is that terrible? Look, I can tell you, no, what he's famous for is tweeting every morning. But I tell you, it's tweetable. Tweetable. It's supposed to be a joke. Tweetable, tweetable. I'll try another Donald Trump joke. Did you hear about the assassination attempt on the President of the United States? Donald Trump? You haven't heard? Didn't see the news this evening. A gunman stood up while President Trump was about to give a talk. He pointed a gun at the president. I don't know how they got it through security. And one of the guards, one of his security agents, saw the gun pointed at the president and shouted out, "Donald, duck!" And the gunman laughed his head off and they could arrest him. Donald Duck. No, I'm trying my best. Is it a terrible place? Or is it a wonderful place of opportunity? We make a mistake. Things go wrong. Do something about it. It's not that terrible. You know, there's wonderful people in this world. So we don't look... I won't go to the story of the two bad bricks. Don't just look at the two bad bricks and think this world is terrible and want to destroy it. Look at the beautiful parts of this world. You've got good health, good education, good friendships. You've got so much more freedoms, so much more opportunities. But sometimes we waste them. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. Great little saying, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. Your lovely husband, it's not the best, not the worst, but you want him to be better, you can't enjoy him. Your beautiful wife? Yeah, you know, she's 60, but she's beautiful. It's amazing just when you change your attitude and the way you look at life. Things aren't terrible anymore. We're adding things onto this world which it doesn't deserve. And we're asking from life things which it can never give us. It's not that terrible, it's just we make it terrible. Oh, if you pursue happiness, you usually get misery. Should it be sought after? Look, if you know what you're chasing, then seek it. But do you really know what happiness is? And sometimes we go seeking for happiness, not realizing it's right where we are. When we stop seeking and just look around us and appreciate what we have, there is instant happiness. I'm happy. I haven't got any money. I haven't got any insurance. I haven't got any retirement plan. I can't look forward to retirement. This is my 67th year, apparently in Hong Kong, that you retire at 65. Mandatory. I'm in Hong Kong. I'm over 65. What am I doing sitting here working? But they told me, Ajahn Brahm, you're not allowed to retire. It's really unfair. I'm going to start a union. I'm going to complain to the government. I'm going to have monks' rights. But apparently, they tell me, the older you are as a monk, the more venerable you are, the harder you have to work. A holy man only really begins his work at 70. So I haven't even started yet. They don't pursue anything. Stop and enjoy. There was this lovely cartoon. I love cartoons. I want happiness. A guy had a piece of paper. He went to the monk. I want happiness. And he was really angry. The monk took his piece of paper, scrubbed off the word I. So it's not about ego and self. You can't be happy when you just think about yourself. What happiness, the piece of paper read. The monk said, second problem. What? That's craving. He took off the what, took off the I. So what does that read?
Happiness.
Happiness is there when you scrub off the I and scrub off the what. Then you have happiness. That is one of the reasons why on this retreat, or this visit, sorry, this teaching tour, I've invented another new word. I like inventing new words. Please don't ask me for a selfie. A selfie is just so egotistical. A selfie on your iPhone. It's all about me. So, do not, you're banned from taking a photo, calling it a selfie on your iPhone. You're only allowed to take weefies. Yeah, it's usually two people in the photograph, so it's not about I, it's we. So anyone who wants to take a weefie either, afterwards, you're most welcome. On your wee phone. And that way you can have much more happiness. So happiness, if you pursue happiness, that is why the pursuit of happiness causes a lot of misery. The reason I wrote the title of that book, Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, the grumpy story was of a person who was at one of my meditation retreats, and I was really sharing about happiness, let go, be happy, be joyful, blah, blah, blah. And that really made her upset. She really got sick of people telling her to be happy. Because she felt miserable. What's wrong with being miserable? And the more other people said, oh, come on, be happy, the more she got miserable. So she came to see me and said, I can't stand this any longer. All these people smiling, I know they're faking it. That's what I think. And I feel so miserable. It makes my misery feel worse, when everyone else is trying to make me happy. So I said, sit here for a moment. I went onto the computer. I logged in. And on this beautiful letterhead and Gothic script, I wrote the first grumpy license. I said, this license, because you have to have a license to drive a car, a license to get married, a license to have a house, a license to practice whatever you're doing in your world, to be a doctor, you have to have a license for almost anything these days. So, do you have to have a license to die, a dying license? You just ask permission from the government before you can die. Interesting, you don't, do you? Give them a chance, they'll do it. Fill out the paperwork before you're allowed to die. Anyway, the grumpy license said, this license gives to the person, I wrote her name there, she was Veronica. this license grants the Veronica permission to be grumpy at any time, for any reason, or no reason what in particular, for the rest of her life, until the coming of Maitreya Buddha, signed Ajahn Brahm. And I dated it. I gave her permission to be miserable. So she didn't have to try so hard to be happy. She had permission from her teacher. She really respected me to be miserable for the rest of her life. And as soon as she got that grumpy license, she was happy for the rest of the retreat. People try so hard at being happy, it makes them sick. So if you're a little grumpy, if I did have the opportunity to change the American Constitution, that's how I would change it. As well as the gun laws and stuff like that, but I would say that you have the right to pursue happiness or grumpiness. You have a right to be grumpy and miserable. Instead of people thinking you're such a failure, you're so hopeless, come on, get your act together, be happy, come on, smile. You're a monk, come on, smile. No, I'll be really grumpy. As soon as I let myself be grumpy, I'll start laughing. So, don't pursue happiness, pursue grumpiness. And it will really make you so happy. It was in a university, it was a chaplaincy interfaith conference, and I was presenting together with a Catholic abbot. There's only two abbots, you know, in Western Australia. So I can't choose, you know, who I can sort of, you know, just discuss abbot business with. There's only one other monastery, it happens to be a Benedictine monastery. So every now and again we meet together, we discuss monk business, not monkey business, monk business. It's amazing just, you know, how many things we have in common, you know, running monasteries. So anyway, he became a good friend, his name was Abbot Placid. And I was asked a question. He was actually standing right next to me when I was asked a question by a gentleman called Father Frank Brennan, who was such an intellectual, so well known. He was the person who the Australian government of the time asked to chair a panel to add a human rights addition to the Australian Constitution. This was, you know, an intellectual heavyweight. So I quickly realised a joke would not be appropriate on this occasion. It was very tough on me not to tell a joke, but there we go. So I started with like an inquiry. I said, the gentleman next to me, my really good friend, Abbot Placid, one of the things he's always been telling me is that one of his fundamental beliefs is that everyone is searching for God. Now, I would not reject the word of a good friend. Now, atheists, Buddhists would say, oh no, Buddhism doesn't believe in a creator God, blah, 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 blah. That doesn't take things further at all. So instead I said, well, this gentleman, my friend, says everyone is searching for God. So, what do Buddhists search for? What do you search for? Why are you coming here this evening? You're searching for, like, happiness, meaning, for respect. To be respected, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, how old you are, any mental disability, to be respected, to have the wonderful ability to be loved and to give love to another human being. So that's what we're seeking for. To be understood, that we're not perfect. And what else? To find peace, meaning, fulfillment. You may add another few things which you're seeking for in this life, and I don't know, no matter what religion or what, whether you're atheist, agnostic or whatever. But if that's what atheists are searching for, and that's what Buddhists search for, respect, meaning, peace, love, truth, and my friend says that's what he believes everyone is searching for God, that must be what God means. Respect, love, to give and receive that love. Trust, meaning, peace. And that was an answer I was very proud of, because that was something which broke down the barriers between religions and those with no religions. Science is something which everybody could agree with and find harmony. Isn't that what we're searching for? Peace, the harmony, the love, respect, forgiveness is in there too. We all make mistakes. So we search for forgiveness. Understand we're not perfect. Please forgive us. We still love each other. And that was something which I'd love to share with more people. So instead of saying, oh, Buddhists don't believe in God, and then, you know, having an argument, let's take it to a much deeper level. So that's Buddhist idea of God. This is my explanation. Make both ends meet. Why do you have to have both ends? Just shorten the piece of string. Well, if you can't make both ends meet, turn them around so they form a circle. What do you mean both ends meet? You have to pay your bills. So, why did you have those bills in the first place? Downsize. It's good. Get a smaller place. It's less worry. A smaller car. Hinayana. Just shave off your hair that you don't have expensive hairdresser bills. So simple. You don't have to have so many clothes. Just get a bicycle or use the MTR. It's much better for the environment. Eat simply. There's so many things you can downsize on. You don't need to be fashionable. Indeed, I can't believe it. These days, fashion, I saw this over in, I think, New York, first of all. Even now, people have holes in their jeans. And you pay all this money to actually to live like a poor person. So, you know, why do you have to spend all this money on fashion? Just keep your old jeans and then you can live fashionably. So on holidays, how many of you have not seen the Great Wall of China yet? Me? You don't need to go see. There's a wall over there. That's a part of the wall. There's a wall over there. It's close enough to China. That counts. It's only a different wall. How many have seen Niagara Falls? Go stand in the shower. Turn it off for a while. It's good enough. You know, we just believe that you haven't lived until you've seen the Grand Canyon. It's great these days, you can actually see it on video. You don't have to go there. Isn't it wonderful? To go on pilgrimage to the holy sites, that's really hard work. Just wait for another couple of years and you'll be able to see it on virtual reality. It saves a lot of travel and trouble. So why do you want to... What do you want money for anyway? Financial burdens? Why? Send your children to a good school? A wonderful, loving mother and father is the best school your kids can ever have. You know, just talking about my father, he wasn't always an honest man, but he was a very loving man. Because I mentioned about the importance of children spending time with their parents. When I was 10, 11 years of age, I started doing really well at football. I got a place in the school football team. And I was so happy I was in the school football team. I said, Dad, I'm playing my first match for the school football team on Saturday morning. Can you come? He said, I have to work on Saturday mornings. You know, just, you know, to make ends meet. So, I have to work on Saturday mornings. So I was really disappointed. But when I was playing football, after the kickoff had already started, there was my father watching by the sideline. You know what that meant to a son? See your dad there? And I was so proud and happy. My dad had found a time, I don't know how, to come and watch his son. And afterwards I asked, Dad, how did you do that? I thought you were supposed to be working. Yeah, I was supposed to be working. But I told my boss I needed a series of injections from the doctor because he knew I was sick, and on a Saturday morning. So he was actually lying, putting his job at risk to see his son play football. That meant so much. He wasn't a rich man. Quite the opposite, very poor. But seeing his son play soccer was more important to him than just keeping his job. That's what I inherited. Tell that to Mr. Trump. Be less afraid. Because always when people, you know, just not face up to the truth of things, you know, that he didn't have the most people at his inauguration. You know, there are problems in the world, but, you know, there's goodness in the world as well. So narcissistic, when you look at yourself and think how wonderful you are. I sometimes joke that Ajahn Brahm is a very humble monk. I spent many years being humble, and I always say, if you put all that energy and effort and time into being humble, what's the point if you don't let people know about it? So if you are humble, flaunt it. That's my saying. Let people know how humble you are. So I reckon I'm the most humble monk in the world, and I want to see if I can get in the Guinness Book of Records the most humble monk. That is narcissism. So less narcissistic, just, you know, allow yourself just to be a human being, which is not perfect. Narcissism is the idea that you are absolutely perfect. You look in the mirror and you think you're perfect. Actually, I look in the mirror, and I made a big discovery when I looked in the mirror, because, you know, I always was worrying about, you know, just trying to find out the meaning of these words, and looked up the meaning of anorexia. Anorexia is a very difficult disease in this world. And when I read out the definition, I realized that was my problem. I looked in the dictionary definition of anorexia, and anorexia is defined in the dictionary as you look in the mirror and you think you're fat. That's me. I look in the mirror and I think I'm fat, so I'm anorexic. Anyway, I have all these excuses for being overweight. Anyway, just because, you know, a senior monk has to have gravitas. Not only that, but true story, it was not this year, a couple of years ago, Chinese New Year, and I was just, you know, people doing a bit of a celebration over in our monastery in Perth, and I was just standing by the door, minding my own business, and this elderly lady, you know, she's obviously Chinese, and couldn't speak a word of English. She came there to celebrate Chinese New Year. She took one look at me and rubbed my belly for good luck. I don't know why she did that. She had good luck, but anyway, I laughed my head off. Funny. Anyway, for narcissism, look, we're afraid of just being who we are. Whatever that is. That is, I've said it so many times, the trees in the forest. You know, sometimes that people are not just narcissism is actually quite rare, but depression and lack of self-worth, that is really, really a problem in our world. Actually, the most problems in our world. You look, go in the forest, I've said it so many times, go in a forest, look for the perfect tree. There is no such thing as a perfect tree. One really straight, all the limbs, the branches equally spaced, only green leaves, no yellow leaves, no brown leaves, no leaves which have been eaten by insects, and a very smooth trunk, a bark with no damage on. Such a tree does not exist in nature. In fact, all the trees in a real forest are bent crooked, with branches hanging off, brown leaves, any green leaves, you know, munched by insects, damage in the bark on the trunk. There's not such a thing as a tree which is dead straight. Really, all trees are damaged. So if you think you're not perfect, you got some damage, a bit bent and crooked. Number one, you belong in the natural forest called humanity, human beings. You're part of a forest. That's why I say people, they've got Down syndrome, people say they've got schizophrenia, we are welcome. Come in. You're part of the forest. Don't be stigmatized and think you don't belong. You get pushed outside into institutions. That is just not the way I think we solve problems. So, you're welcome. And number two, if you really are damaged goods, you know that word they use these days? Damaged goods. And you've had some abuse in your past, some really bad experiences. The most damaged trees, so crooked, so bent, so twisted, and all knobbly on the outside, they are some of my most favorite trees. The trees I like to be with again and again. The damaged trees become the most beautiful. It's inclusiveness, changing our value system to realize that you're already good enough. In the deepest teachings of Buddhism, it's not about changing yourself, it's about loving yourself, opening the door of your heart to how you are, and appreciating yourself, seeing the goodness and the beauty, and it blossoms. You don't have to change anything except your attitude. A wonderful thing. So I don't have to, lose weight. You would recognize me if I did. Would be the same old Ajahn Brahm. You'd have nothing to rub on Chinese New Year. So anyway, that is just about how narcissism, lack of self-worth. Go into nature, go into a forest and check that out. What is your favorite tree, the one which is most beautiful? And then you'll understand human beings don't need to be perfect. They're not perfect anyway. They're bent, crooked, damaged. We're all damaged from things which happen to us in our life to a greater or lesser extent. Don't hide it. Celebrate it as your beauty. Easily become a monk or a nun. If that doesn't work, now honestly, go to a forest and look at the trees. Go out there and find who you think is the most beautiful tree. And it's not what you expect. If you see the worth in a damaged tree, then see the worth in yourself. So if you are, before you get into deep depression, you do really need to have some medication, unfortunately. That's the only real way to kick you out of that. But don't allow yourself to get into the really deep depressions. When you see it happening, just start to understand, okay, this is my strategies. The sorts of things which, I can get and they're readily available to actually lift up my mood. When you start to get a little bit depressed. First of all, just relaxing, resting, listen to some funny movies, favorite music, favorite food, Ajahn Brahm talks, books, whatever. So you get to so deep and you're in a hole, it's hard to get out. But before you get so deep, see if you can catch yourself. There was one fellow monk of mine, it's not depression, but a similar thing, that he was in the military in the Vietnam War. He got shot in the back of the head, and he thought he was going to be blind. He was going to commit suicide. He found out, once the bandages were removed, he could see He had this big pension from the US for being dumped, for being injured, and eventually became a monk. Literally being shot in the back of the head knocked some sense into him. But he was always, if he ever got stressed, he would have epileptic fits because of the damage to the brain. And what he did, you know, before mindfulness training was really known, because he was a monk, he would watch just the process in his mind coming up to an epileptic fit. Now, when the fit was actually full blast, he couldn't do anything about it, but he could see, you know, the precursors to the fit. And he could be aware earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier until he became so aware of the process, the mental process which preceded the fit, he could catch it so early. As soon as he said, "I'm now going to go take a rest." Now, he was able to catch it so early, and he had all of the strategies, mostly just going to a dark room and just relaxing and resting and not doing anything, that he never had those fits again. The mindfulness actually caught them early, so he could actually go a different route. Same with depression. If you can catch it earlier and earlier and earlier, you can find your own strategies, so you don't have to go through that again. How does it, good, bad, who knows, doesn't matter what happens to you. You know, if you lose your job, wonderful, you can take a rest and break and just recover. You know, how difficult it is to get like a couple of weeks or a month off work. You've lost your job, great, now I can relax and enjoy, get my health back together again. Ah, you know, your girlfriend dumps you, oh, wonderful, you can save a lot of money. And you may be able to get a better model next time. Same with guys as well. But also, and if they really dump you, wonderful! You can become a monk. That's what happened to me. My girlfriend dumped me. Oh, thank you so much. I've never met her these days. I don't know where she's gone to, what happened to her, but oh, thank you so much. You know, I fell in love when I was 19. 6 months of bliss, happily together, and then, she dumped me for another guy. Oh, thank you so much, thank you, thank you, thank you. If you hadn't dumped me, I would have never become a monk. Oh, thank you so much. So whatever, you look at the positive side of things. So then you can't be anxious about your future. Because you know whatever your future holds, it's always wonderful. With your attitude, doesn't matter what happens. What was I telling somebody the other day? I travel around a lot. So some of my followers said, "Ajahn Brahm, you should be really, 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 really careful. Because, you know, there were sometimes terrorists on the aircraft." You know what's coming, don't you? And I said, "Ajahn Brahm, what would you do, you know, if there was a terrorist on the aircraft and you were shot down?" And he said, "Well, number one, if, you know, I survived the explosion and the aircraft broke apart, this would be my parachute. It's a very big rope. This rope acts as a parachute. It's about 3 meters by 2 meters. I can hold and just go down. I probably would, you know, maybe break a leg or something, but I wouldn't die because hold on, you just float down. So this is my parachute." So what happens if, you know, you fall in a Muslim country? They see, you know, a Buddhist, you know, a Kuai Lo, white person. No, the first one. I said, "Look, all I do is I'll push this up a bit and it'll be my burqa." And they wouldn't know there's a white guy underneath. It's using initiative. That's initiative. But what happens if the whole aircraft explosion, a big explosion? Then what? I said, that's where I got the three benefits of dying in an aircraft explosion at 36,000 feet. One of the best ways to die. Firstly, instant cremation. You know what it's like in Hong Kong, going to a funeral parlour, making an appointment, paying lots of money, getting all of your family and relations from all over the place to come. Oh, that's just a headache. Aircraft explosion instantaneously, and have the extra benefit, ashes scattered. No extra charge. And talking about charge, these days funeral services are very, very expensive. Sometimes they cost your family a lot of money. Because if that's, you know, your grandfather, your grandma, you know, you can't do it cheap. You've got to look after them. But if it's an aircraft explosion, you've got no choice. And number two, you know, is actually you actually make money out of grandma's death because you get the insurance payout. So family does it. It's not difficult financial times these days. You know, you've got to sort of make ends meet. So that's the second advantage, a financial benefit. And the third advantage, if you die in an aircraft explosion at 36,000 feet, you are so close to heaven, it's easy to go the rest of the way. You're almost there. So those are the three positive things about dying in an aircraft explosion. But this is, don't worry about things. You know, you just look at the future, positive mind, you can always do something. And this is because this is the year of the dog. I've been channeling the wisdom of one of the greatest American philosophers who ever lived. The greatest American philosopher, my favorite, Snoopy the dog. A good friend of Charlie Brown in the Peanuts cartoons. And one of his great sayings, Snoopy, the year of the dog. Don't demean dogs. Dogs are really cool. I really admire their wisdom. Do dogs have stress? Dogs, they just sleep all day. They don't have to work for their food. All they have to do is wag their tail when they see you. A few wags of the tail and you love them. They take you for a walk in the morning. It's not you take them. You take them for a walk. They take you for a walk. And they rest all day, relaxed, free healthcare, nothing to worry about. Who's the smart ones? You or the dogs? Anyway, do the dogs ever get stuck in traffic? Of course they don't. They're just sitting out there enjoying, you know, doing nothing all day. So I think maybe they may be higher beings. Anyway, certainly Snoopy. In many ways, he said, worrying does not stop bad things happening. Bad things will happen anyway, whether you worry or not. But it stops you enjoying the good things happening now. Worry does not stop bad things happening. It just stops you enjoying the good things happening now. In fact, my experience is when you worry about something, you're more likely to happen. So, just let go. Well, the other beautiful wisdom of Snoopy, which I was saying, was this is actually insight. Thinking deeply. Whether a university should really understand that sometimes we think something is so obvious it must be true, and no, you can go much deeper than that. This is where Charlie Brown said to Snoopy, you know, one day we will die. Is that wrong? Can you argue with that? Snoopy can. That one day we will all die is human wisdom. Snoopy wisdom is this. He said, yes, one day we will all die, but most days we don't die. That's really amazing. Did you think of that? One day you will die, but most days you don't die. Anyway, I like Snoopy wisdom, dog wisdom. And anyway, this is about worry. When you worry about things, it doesn't stop the bad things happening. It stops you enjoying the things happening right now. How stupid worry is. Anyway, I better do some more questions. Otherwise you make me worried, I might not answer them. wonderful you made the connection with anger, exhaustion. The two of them come together. The exhaustion is what feeds the anger, and the anger just makes you more exhausted. So how to release it? The old story of the monster. Kids love stories of monsters. So, there was... Okay, let's change this. Usually, monster in the emperor's palace. So let's call it the monster in the vice chancellor of Hong Kong University study. Did that work? So, when the vice chancellor of Hong Kong University was coming to listen to this talk, are they here? No? Okay, well, they should be. The vice chancellor was coming to the talk. When he was away, this monster, this demon, went right through the security in the administrative building into the chancellery and sat in the vice chancellor's chair in his office. He was so frightening, so powerful, so ugly, that the security, who was supposed to stop people coming in, they hid. They went under the tables, behind the desks, in the cupboards, because they were scared. And that allowed this monster to go right into the vice chancellor's room, office, and sit in the chair. And as soon as he sat in the chair, the security came out and realized they'd lose their jobs if they don't get rid of this monster. So they said, "Get out of here. You don't belong. Get out now. We'll call the police. We'll call the SWAT team." Do you have a SWAT team in Hong Kong? Yeah. Okay. "We'll call the SWAT team." And at those unkind words, the monster, the demon, grew an inch bigger, more frightening, more ugly, and more smelly. And by the time the SWAT team came with the machine guns, oh, this monster was so huge and so terrifying that even the SWAT team was scared and couldn't do anything. And that was when the Vice Chancellor came into his room and saw this huge, frightening, stinky monster sitting in his room. He was so frightening that made, I don't know, I've never seen these movies, Alien was supposed to be the most frightening monster in the movies. It was voted. And it was very close. I think Donald Trump was the next most. I'll get into trouble, I'll go to the United States. But anyway, so frightening. But this monster in the Vice Chancellor's office, made the alien monster look like a teddy bear. Like a little pussycat. This monster was really mean and nasty and frightening. And the smell, the stench coming off this monster's skin was so bad that even made maggots crawling on his skin throw up. Even the maggots were sick on that stinky monster. And as soon as the VC, the Vice Chancellor, came in, he knew exactly... Is it he or she now? Him? Okay. He knew exactly what to do. You know what he said? He said, "Welcome, monster. Thank you so much for visiting me. Has anyone got you anything to drink yet?" And that was sincere kindness. And of those few kind words, the monster shrank an inch, got less aggressive, less ugly, and less smelly. And the SWAT team realized their mistake. They put down their guns, and they went up to that monster, had his huge feet, and they gave him a foot massage. Foot massage is really nice, really relaxes you, and they were really caring, just getting the right spot, oh, just there, just there, that's just nice. They asked the monster if he wanted anything to eat. You know, we got some noodles. We've got oodles of noodles for such a big monster. Would you like some porridge or some dumplings? And this monster, every time they got a kite on, I don't know where the monster was. Maybe it was a quailone, you know, because, you know, quailone means a scary white man. So they said, maybe you want a pizza. The reason I say pizza, because then you can get monster-sized pizzas these days. So they got a monster-sized pizza for him. Every kind work, kind deed, kind thought, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. Until that monster was so small that one more act of kindness and the monster shrank and completely disappeared. That is based on a story told by the Buddha in the Yakasamyutta, the anger eating monster. I added a few different points, which I'll let you work out. But the basis is the same. You give them anger. Get out of here. You don't belong. This isn't the real me. And it gets worse. It feeds on anger. You give it kindness. Welcome. Thank you for being here. And it shrinks. Anger eating monster. Exhaustion. Depression. Anger eating. I don't want to feel depressed. Oh, I don't want to feel depressed. If you give it anger fighting, it lasts much longer. Be kind to it. It will pass. And even the anger in your mind, we have what we call double anger. Anger of being angry. I'm not angry, and I'll smash anyone who says I am. That's anger at being angry, so we deny it. So that's how to get rid of anger and exhaustion. It's not trapped in you. Be kind to it. Welcome it. Thank you, anger. Kentucky Fried. Kentucky Fried Duck. Joke. There was a duck. And it was trying to cross a busy road in Hong Kong. And a chicken came by and said, don't try that. Don't try and cross the road. I crossed the road once, and people have never let me forget it. Why did a chicken cross the road? Don't get that joke, do you? Why did a duck? Okay, try another one. Two ducks were swimming in the pond. One duck said to the other, quack. The other one said, I was going to say that. Oh, I really do try. Come on. Don't make me depressed. I was giving a keynote address at a human rights conference in London. It was in Docklands, had this new convention centre called Excel Convention Centre. They flew me all the way from Australia to London, put me up in a nice hotel, just for about an hour's talk. And when I was in the convention centre just waiting for the talk to begin, the organisers said there were two people trying to get into the talk, saying they were my relations. And I said, well, they never told me they were coming. Are you sure it's not a scam? So I went down to the reception area. Sure enough, it was my brother and my niece. You know what my niece calls me? Because not Uncle Brown, calls me Munkle Brown. So I'm their Munkle. So anyway, and I just, this is real, I've come all the way over here, please let them in. So he let them in, and then as soon as they were let in for free, I said, why you cheapskates embarrassing me? You know, you're a banker, and I think a daughter has got a really good job. You know, why can't you pay the fee? And they said, because it was £200 each. Now I know my market value. You are getting me cheap. Cut price. So what is your market value? another time somebody rang up and they said, I hear you teach meditation. I said, yeah, I teach meditation. Quite well known as a meditation teacher. People really like me. So how much do you charge? You know what I said? Nothing. For free. You know what she said on the telephone? Well, you can't be any good then. And hung up. Because people have the idea the more you pay, the better it is. So it's amazing. Just, now what is my worth? You come in here for free, so I can't be worth anything. So I never say that these days. When they say, how much do you have to pay to come into one of my talks? I say, it is priceless. It's a wonderful saying, priceless, because you know, it's beyond price. So what are you worth? You're priceless. Honestly. So if you have a lack of self-worth, it's not you're worth nothing. It's not that you're worth £100 or £200 or $1,000. What is, you know, the person in the top of Forbes magazine? Who's the wealthiest person in this room? Ajahn Brahm is priceless. So, it's changing the idea of worth. So, if you think you don't deserve happiness, you're not worthy for love, first of all, learn how to love oneself. And an exercise for you all to love yourself, please follow me, put your hands up like this. Follow me, bring them in, and follow me. And those people found it difficult doing that, you're the people who feel you don't deserve love. So practice. Practice hugging yourself. Maybe in private, so you don't feel embarrassed. And then go to the next stage of hugging yourself in public. You know, it actually really feels good. You get this big rush of endorphins, it feels really good. And you know, it's very difficult these days, and all these diseases, swine flu, and there's bird flu, there's this disease and that disease, chicken flu in Hong Kong. So it's sometimes very difficult to know if you get hugged by someone, what you might catch. But if you hug yourself, you've already got it anyway, whatever you might catch, so you feel safe. So that's a wonderful thing to do. But actually, I did actually mention to you that, because I know some of you have sat quite close when you've taken photographs, we should have actually, I've been a bit remiss, I have been diagnosed as having a communicable disease. Absolutely contagious without any remedy. It's called Hepatitis B. Not hepatitis, Hepatitis. If you hang around close enough, you might get the virus. So, welcome to Hepatitis B epidemic, starting in this little room. And hopefully it spreads.